This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Fans of the sitcom The Office might remember this.
How much is this going to cost?
It costs what it costs.
No, don't. That doesn't even mean anything.
Okay? We have gone through this.
Yes. Money has been a little bit tight lately, but at the end of my life, when I'm sitting on my yacht, am I going to be thinking about how much money I have? No, I'm going to be thinking about how many friends I have and my children and my comedy albums.
Why is it so hard for some of us to wrap our heads around money? We fret over it and laugh about it, but are we being productive? I mean, we know that impulse purchases can be trouble. We can all relate to buyer's remorse. We know that. But it might help to have a better grasp of why we make these purchases and how savvy businesses use human nature against us. Joining us from NPR in New York is Dan Ariely, a social scientist and professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University. He's the founder and director of Duke's behavioral economics lab called the Center for Advanced Hindsight. And he is the co-author of the new book, Dollars and Cents, S-E-N-S-E, How We Misthink Money and How to Spend Smarter. Professor Ariely, welcome to 1A.
Nice to be here.
Also joining us at NPR in New York is his co-author, Jeff Kreisler, a comedian and the author of the satirical book called Get Rich Cheating. He's the recipient of the Bill Hicks Spirit Award for thought-provoking comedy. Jeff, welcome.
Good to be here, too.
We welcome your questions, thoughts, and stories about dealing with impulse purchases. What did you buy that you came to regret, and what did you learn from buying it? Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Professor Ariely, I wonder why you decided to write the book and what your approach was, especially considering that we all kind of already know that impulse purchases are a thing. What did you want to accomplish with this book?
So first of all, it's not just about impulse purchases, but if you think about money, we deal with money all the time. We deal with it many times a day. And because of that, we often think that we understand how money works and that we sometimes often make good decisions with money. And the point here was to take a step back and to say, let's think about this entity called money, and let's think about are we really making good decisions? Are we making bad decisions? Under what conditions? Where do we fail? And give people some tools to rethink money under conditions where we might fail. And then the second part of it is that we're kind of facing a really interesting digital age. As long as we have physical money, you know, we're limited with how money works. We just open our wallet and we have these bills. But the moment we move to digital currency, we have lots of flexibility. And that flexibility also means that we can fail more, but it also means that we can actually rethink about how we use money and make it our ally rather than failing to make good decisions with money.
Jeff Kreisler, I imagine that money for you has been pretty fertile territory for comedy, especially since we can all kind of relate to how difficult it is to wrangle our money and how goofy we feel when we make a dumb decision.
Absolutely. My first book you mentioned, Get Rich Cheating, was all about how the drive for money and the fact that we can't get as rich as we think we ought to be will drive people towards unethical behavior. And it essentially is one piece of this whole that Dan and I address in the book about how just money does all these things to our mind, whether it's unethical behavior or illogical or irrational behavior, and it is fertile ground. I mean, you can have clips from almost any show. You had The Office. Larry David does stuff. Seinfeld does stuff. We all obsess about money, and yet we don't really think about how we think about it. And in working with Dan and learning all of this, it just revealed so many things that we make mistakes that we make ourselves, and then opportunities that we open the door for others to take advantage of our mistakes and our thinking.
Let's try to put a little bit of research behind kind of our suppositions about money. Professor Ariely, your book outlines that we are rarely acting purely rationally when it comes to the way we use money. But can you give us an idea of how bad we really are? I mean, what does the research tell us about just how irrational we may be with money?
Okay. So first of all, call me Dan, not Professor Ariely. So think about the following. Decisions about money should be decisions about opportunity cost, right? What is money? We can buy many, many things with money. which means that every time you're buying one thing with money, you're giving up something else. That's the notion of opportunity cost. And that's the great thing with money. The problem is that the same thing that makes money so useful also makes it very, very hard to think about. So, for example, a few years ago, we went to a Toyota dealership, and these were people who were about to buy a new car. And we said, look, if you're going to buy this new car, what are you giving up? And we pushed people to give us an answer, and people had no answer. Why? Because they never thought about it. And then we pushed them, and we said, look, if you buy this car, something will have to give. Something will have to give. What is it? And the most common answer we got was, if I don't buy a Toyota, I can buy a Honda. Or if I buy a Toyota, I can't buy a Honda. So people were giving us a substitution within the same time frame, in the same category. But they should have said something like, if I go ahead and buy this car, I'm giving 3 weeks of vacation for the next 3 years and 700 books and three lattes and whatever it is. But so the point is that money, we should be thinking about opportunity cost. Every time you go to buy a cup of coffee, every time you go to a movie, you should be thinking about opportunity cost. But that thought is so complex, so we don't. So how do we think about money? We take all kinds of shortcuts. And as we take those shortcuts, they are not ideal, and they get us to fail. And I'll give you one example of a shortcut we take. We take the shortcut of relativity. We think about money in relative ways. So I don't know about you, but have you ever, renovated an apartment or a house or something like that?
We're actually getting ready to, yeah.
Okay. So here's, you're in luck. So here's what happens when you renovate an apartment. You, at some point, the contractor comes to you and he says, for only $2,000 more, you could get something Italian. And that something will change. Something, it will be granite, sometime it will be faucets, whatever it will be, but it will always be something Italian, and it will be at least $2,000. And you will think about it for about 30 seconds, and then you'll say, it's only $2,000. That's not a big deal. And then you'll say, yes, let's do it. And then you'll go to the supermarket and you'll stand by the tomatoes and you'll look at the expensive tomatoes and the cheap tomatoes and you'll wonder which tomatoes you should get. And your whole life making decisions about tomatoes will not mount up to this quick decisions you make about adding something Italian to your renovation. But the problem is, and the reason is, that when you deal with a big amount, something like $2,000 looks small in comparison. Your bank account doesn't care. It's still $2,000. But if you have a big bill to pay, $2,000, you look at it in a relative way, like a proportion, a percentage. It looks very small to you, relatively speaking. And therefore, we make really rash, irrational decisions because the main amount is high. And then when you buy tomatoes, the amount is small to start with, so every decision looks like it's big. So that's one example.
I can remember particularly seeing that when on a big family vacation once that must have cost thousands of dollars, my family would argue over a $5 cab fare, right? The big ones, we don't think about. The little ones, we obsess over.
Jeff, I wonder if you could respond to this tweet from Ashley in Maryland. Ashley writes, American culture makes talking about money taboo. We need to be more open with friends and with our children. Jeff, I'm not sure I fully agree with that. I mean, we talk a lot about money in this culture, but I think I know what she's getting at in terms of having the real conversation about money. Is that maybe partly why you choose to do it somewhat through comedy to make it a little easier to discuss?
Absolutely, 100%. One of the things that I wanted to accomplish with this and working with Dan was to make a difficult topic more accessible. All of us obviously think about money and we talk about money a lot, but we don't really talk about it productively. You know, we can see our spending. We can see if someone gets a nice car or a bigger house or a fancier this or that, but we don't really ever talk about savings. How many of us have ever had a conversation asking someone, hey, have you contributed to your 401k or your child's college savings
account?
Let's
talk about this. How much are you saving?
Not enough. We'll see how the book sales go. Then we'll save some more. But we don't have this conversation. And I have found myself, since I started writing this book, being much more open with my neighbors and my family and my friends.
Let's do it now. So you have two kids.
I have two kids.
They have college savings accounts?
One has a college savings account. The other is just 7 months old. And you know what? She's just... There's not going to be college by then.
Okay.
So I don't know if you've seen the news, but we're eliminating higher education. That's a priority in the country, so she'll be fine.
And that's the... Even though, you know, we're friends and we've talked
about uncomfortable.
Lots of things, it is uncomfortable.
My blood pressure went up. I was ready to run out of the room.
I can feel that. Do we have to discuss this right now?
and it is tough. And you know, there are are more questions to ask. And the caller, Ashley, is absolutely right. You know, we...
Twitter, Dan. It's the modern
sorry,
age.
Sorry. It's Twitter. Yes. I date myself. And it's really interesting, right? If you talk to people about, like, what kind of life insurance do you have, and what would happen if you die to your family? And these are really important things. And not only that, if we don't share information among us, how will we ever learn? Otherwise, we're really at the mercy of the companies who sell us these services, right? The moment we start talking to each other, we can figure out things, but we don't talk.
Well,
about
and then maybe part somebody, of the challenge of it is just finding an appropriate place to kind of have that conversation. I mean, it's not an easy conversation to have, although. This is a perfectly appropriate place to have the conversation, which is why I hope that those of you listening will share your questions and thoughts and stories about how you are wrangling your money as we continue the conversation with Dan Ariely of Duke University, Jeff Kreisler, his co-author on the book Dollars and Cents. Still to come, we will be hearing from another one of our regular guests, Michelle Singletary, personal finance expert, will be with us to give us some additional guidance, but we welcome your stories as well. Email us, 1a@wamu.org. Comment on our Facebook page or tweet us at 1A. Several of you have commented about your regrettable or lamentable purchases. James writes on Facebook that he's never made a purchase that he's regretted. Oh, look at James. Aaron wrote on our Facebook page a gym membership. Sorry to hear that. Although I've made a gym membership purchase that I regretted, not because I was working out, but because of that gym. Daniel wrote us on Facebook, the two happiest days of a boat owner's life are when they buy the boat and when they sell it. I just sold mine about 2 weeks ago, and I'm still celebrating. Note, I've received tons of boat messages, by the way, to 1A. So, Daniel, you are definitely not alone. But, Dan Ariely, that was one of the kinds of purchases that you talk about in the book. These big purchases, particularly the ones that you have to pay off in pieces, something big like a boat.
Yes. So actually, if you think about the three people, the person who said they don't regret anything, my guess is that they just don't have a good memory or an amazing ability to rationalize.
Or a trust fund.
That's one. We actually regret lots of purchases. I think we don't think enough about what we regret. Every time we buy something, it's forward-looking. We say, oh, how this will make us feel. But from time to time, looking back at what we purchased is actually a really good strategy. And we did a study not too long ago. We kind of wrote a little tool that went into people's bank accounts and pulled one transaction at a time and said, to what extent do you regret this one and this one and this one and so on. And the category we saw that people regretted the most was actually going out. And it's not because going out to dinner is a bad thing, but the moment you go out to dinner, you're at the mercy of the restaurant, under the influence of the waiter and the menu and so on, and people end up eating too much and drinking too much and then regret it. So once you understand where regret is coming from, then you should change your behavior. Now, in terms of the last person, the boat, the thing is that when we look forward to something, we sometimes see the advantages and we don't see the disadvantages as much. In particular, we don't see what is called the pain of paying. So imagine you have a boat and you pay, whatever, $2,000 a month to have it dock somewhere. Every day that passes, people kind of have a pain. They pay for that. Every month they pay for it and they don't use it. And they don't use it. And it's a very, very unpleasant feeling to basically pay for something you don't use. And it's a little bit like a gym. Because there's actually beautiful results showing that people who buy gym membership on their credit card and the credit card are charged every month, on the day when the credit card is charged, the next day they're slightly more likely to go to the gym. They remember that they're paying for it and now they need to justify it. So the
agony. I guess
agony,
it's kind of a good thing.
Think about in New York, right? What's the difference between owning a car and renting a car? For most people, renting a car makes much more economic sense. But you feel this pain of paying. You go on the weekend and you have to pay $300 or $400. If you own a car, you pay for it all the time. It's much more expensive. It sits in the garage waiting for you, but you don't have these ongoing payments. And ongoing payments are basically things that create a tremendous amount of human misery.
Yeah, speaking of ongoing payments, we asked you to share stories about purchases that you regretted. Here is one voicemail that one of you left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Katrina, and I'm calling from North Carolina. We were talking about buyer's regret, and the biggest thing our family has ever had buyer's regret for was an airplane. We purchased an airplane after we moved back to the United States, serving in the military, and it caused us so much trouble. It seemed like the perfect thing. It was a warbird. It was seemed like so much fun. But the repairs and the time and just the trouble was totally not worth it. Don't buy an airplane.
Katrina, thanks very much for your message. Jeff, I wonder about Katrina's message, what you think of that, especially because there seems to be a piece of sentimentality wrapped up in it. I mean, they said they purchased the airplane after moving back to the U.S. after serving in the military and described it as a warbird. So maybe it was a plane that they planned to just restore or something like that. But sentiment gets in the way.
It seems to me that they may be more of the Paradise Papers type.
I think she meant like an old propeller plane.
Yeah, just like the Sopwith Camel from Charlie Brown that he used to fly around in. I think that goes to the similar thing Dan was talking about with the book. With the yacht, that there's this pain of paying, or there's a pain of maintenance that they've spent money on this item, but it becomes a burden and they don't really get to ever enjoy it. And so if we don't get to enjoy it because we're spending money maintaining it, or for them maybe they have to keep painting it or fixing it, then it doesn't just create that nostalgia. It creates a burden. It creates something that they have to do. In paying, it's, as Dan said, every month you pay your gym bill or you pay your rental fee or whatever it is. And for them, it sounds like it was a lot more than that. So this nostalgic idea, it was a great dream that they thought they would achieve by having a plane, but they might have been better off getting a picture of a plane and going to an air museum every couple months.
Let me get to a few more of your comments before we have to pause. Deborah in Silver Spring, Maryland emailed, "My grandmother taught me that if you can't pay for it in cash, you don't buy it. Good advice. Also, if you pay the 30% interest on a credit card, you should have gone to a nicer restaurant. Pay it off in full." And Fred emailed, "When I think about spending money, I also think about how much money that expense will make me. For instance, $3 million for an airplane, which will lease for $4.5 million per year. That way I'm actually making money instead of just spending it." Interesting idea, Fred. And when we come back, we want to talk more about how to apply some of this behavioral knowledge to our own lives. Yeah, you may make a purchase. Yes, it's a lot of money, but it's not inherently bad if you find a way to make the dollars work out. So how do you do that? Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Dan Ariely and Jeff Kreisler, the authors of the new book, Dollars and Cents. We welcome your questions and thoughts about controlling some of the irrationality in how we spend money, or some of the irrational purchases or financial decisions you made that you have come to regret and learn from. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Let's add one more voice into the mix to give us a little bit of advice and guidance. Joining us from our home base in Washington is our friend Michelle Singletary, syndicated columnist of The Color of Money for The Washington Post. Michelle, welcome back to 1A.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I always love having you on because I think of something you said the first time we had you on, which was, if debt was a person, I'd slap him in the mouth. That works for me. And I love it. And I wonder if, Michelle, I could get you to respond to Deborah's comment from Silver Spring that we read a few minutes ago. Deborah emailed, "My grandmother taught me that if you can't pay for it in cash, you don't buy it. Good advice. Also, if you pay the 30% interest on a credit card, you should have gone to a nicer restaurant. Pay it off in full." How much of this, Michelle, do you think is part of what Dan was saying earlier, that we're so much more digital, that money is much more a concept as opposed to an object that you have to count out 10, 20, 30, 40, and it becomes almost conceptual.
Absolutely. I was raised by my grandmother, Big Mama, and she had a similar thing. She hated debt. She believed in paying in cash. She believed in thinking through purchases. So I think it's great. Listen, I love this book because it talks about money and decision making and the fact that one of the concepts of this book that is just so brilliant and backed by research is this whole idea that we've been separated from the pain of paying through credit cards and swiping our phones. And here's why it's so dangerous, because it doesn't allow for you to really think about what you're doing at the time. Even when we buy a car, I joke to folks when I talk to them in seminars and things that if we had to pay cash for our cars, we would all be driving, you know, Ford Escorts. You know?
We'd be driving Ford Model T's.
A bicycle, I'm saying. Because if you had to peel off those thousands of dollars, you'd be thinking, well, wait a minute. I got to send a kid to college. I need to put more money in my retirement fund. And can I just read this line from this book? Because I'm telling you, if you don't listen to anything else that we say today, you got to listen from this. It says, we are constantly fighting external forces, trying to get us to spend more, more frequently, and more freely. There are numerous forces that want us to incorrectly assess true value because it profits them when we spend irrationally. That's brilliant. Like, for real.
I think we have a new publicist.
Yes, I think so.
I think you do.
Or an additional one. We love our publicist. Yes.
But Michelle, I wonder about, you know, technology may be a part of the problem. How much for the solution side also comes through technology? I mean, there are plenty of apps and websites. There's almost too many ways to track your spending these days, even though it's much more digital, feels much more virtual.
Right.
But you can use that same digital virtual world to help control your spending, too.
You know, yes, we can. And then the book actually talks about this whole idea of how we have put our budgeting in boxes, and it's been helped by all these digital applications. But here's the problem. That's not why we don't spend well. It's not that we don't have enough boxes. It's not that we don't have enough really good apps. It's because we're not rational about how we spend our money. We need to spend more time thinking about why we buy things than just how we budget. And I'm a big budgeter. I believe in pots. I'm a pot person. But I spend an enormous amount of time thinking about how I spend my money, large and small. And it's so funny when Dan asked Jeff that question, I will tell you right away, I got 3 college funds. I can tell you what's in everyone. I don't have any problem. If I'm in a grocery market and I'm seeing you do something crazy, I'm going to ask you what's going on. I'm going to, do you have a retirement account? Because we have to think about these things. And the small and the large. And here's why. And I'm going to be really quickly. I was in a line. Every school year, I buy paper for one of my favorite teachers. In high school that my daughter had, because they don't have enough supplies. And I went to the store and I knew that the papers were around $25 the last time I bought it, the last school season. And it was on sale, quote unquote, for $59. And I went up to the cash register. I was like, whoa, wait a minute. And they said, no. If you, it's $59, but there's a $30 rebate. And you have to, I said, okay, so what's the catch? So you have to send in for the rebate and then we'll send you back the $30. Okay, so what's the $30? A gift card to the store. And I said, and there's like 5 people behind me tapping their toes. Don't tap your toes at me. And I said, wait a minute. This is not a good deal because I have to come back and spend $30. I never intend to be. Why can't I just spend the $25 that y'all charged for this last time? Right. And she said, well, this is the deal. Well, it's not my deal. I got out of the line, took that big box of paper, put it back, and went to the store where I knew it was $25 because that was not a... They were trying to get me with this whole concept of a discount. You're not going to fool me.
And then that's it's not even really... And then the way you describe it, it's not really even $30 of savings. It's $30 of a gift card. So you've already locked that $30 into their economic ecosystem that you have to spend with them eventually.
Exactly. See, that's what we need to spend more time with. That's why I love this book, because it's about getting to your mind first. We got the tools. Y'all, that's not the problem, y'all.
Right.
Y'all got the budget. You got the tools. Now you've got to really think through these things, small and large.
Well, let me, Dan Ariely, let me come back to you and Jeff for just a second, to another aspect of this that I think we kind of have to grapple with in terms of the way that we use money. And setting aside, you know, saving for college and having a retirement account, which I think are unquestionable, you just need to save for the future. But in terms of the way we spend irrationally, sometimes it's just fun. It's just fun to be able to say, I'm going to go to Vegas with a few thousand and just live like, you know, like an NBA star. Or say, I'm going to go to Walt Disney World and I'm just going to buy whatever my kid wants. We're going to eat in whatever restaurants we go to. Or to say, you know, I'm going to go to the mall and I haven't treated myself in a long time and I'm going to derive benefit from the freedom of not worrying about my money. Like, that's a human need. That's a catharsis is a need too. And I wonder what we do with that. I can't really judge somebody for saying, I've been working really hard. I've been very diligent with my money. I want to cut loose just for 2 hours with my money. Dan, what about that?
So first of all, I think life is about kind of balancing responsibility and fun. You don't want it. It's not the race to who can die with the most money. So, you know, we do need this balance. The real issue is what is called hedonic treadmill, is that we start doing these things, we start spending more money, and then we get used to that. And from that perspective, I actually like Black Friday. I know people spend an awful lot of money on Black Friday, but here is something that we find in some experiments. If you go and indulge on Black Friday and you buy extra whatever, you don't take that as an input and start spending more the rest of your life. If you just go on a random Tuesday and buy more things, you've kind of elevated your own decisions and now you're more likely to start spending more on any particular day. So having fun is great, but you want to balance it out. So for example, people who go to a really expensive dinner on Valentine's Day are unlikely to keep on doing it on a regular basis. But if you just pick a regular Friday and you go to an expensive restaurant, next week you're going to consider it as well. So we should try to have fun, but we should try to balance that fun. And then the other thing about kind of irrational spending is the way we spend compared to our neighbors. You know, there's this expression, keeping up with the Joneses.
Yeah.
There was a study recently that showed that when people win the lottery, their neighbors start spending more money. and the neighbors start spending more money to an extent that some of them go bankrupt. And it's because we have this sense of how much do we need to spend, and we look at the neighbors around us, it gives us a sense of what we need to spend, what we need to accomplish. And our savings are basically hidden. Like if you think about how people used to save, let's say 1,000 years ago, people used to save in goats and chickens. And in those days, you could come home and you could look at how many goats and chickens your neighbor has and how many goats and chickens you have. And we could compete on who is saving more, who has more goats and chickens. But then we invented money and then digital money. And what happened is this unhealthy balance between saving, which is invisible, and spending, which is incredibly visible. And we would compete on anything as long as we could see it and we can measure it. And saving and insurance became invisible, while spending is becoming increasingly visible. So we compete on that. And we compete on that not necessarily maximizing our long-term well-being, but we are kind of maximizing our feeling of competition and wanting to improve. But it's unhealthy for our long-term well-being. So some consumption is great. We should all figure out how to be happy, but we need to figure out also the balance between those.
Let me get to a few more of your comments in the time we have left with Michelle Singletary, Dan Ariely, and Jeff Chrysler. Jonathan emailed, "We bought a sailboat, which we stay on the weekends when we Airbnb our house. It has more than paid for itself in 2 years. Not all boat purchases are regretted." Kushi emailed us, "The conversation about money needs
to—" I have to stop you. Who are your listeners? It's like boats and planes. What's the targeting of this show?
Well, maybe to that point, we should read the comment from Joanna in Lacona, New York, who emailed, "I believe you described this part of the hour as dealing with money in the lives of ordinary people, but mostly it seems to be about the people affluent enough to buy boats, planes, gym memberships, people far richer than my neighbors and me. Not that richer people don't also need to think about money, but to acknowledge that they are on the comfortable end of normal might be helpful."
Can I just jump in? We don't even really know that's true. It could be that person had a boat and they sacrificed a whole lot to get that boat. They have no retirement. Their kids have a boatload pun intended, of student loan debt. I mean, people say, and we look at their purchases, but we don't really know what's behind that. We see someone, a Mercedes or a BMW, and think, well, they've got it like that, but they might not have it like that. And that's why we need to not comparison. Those folks who have both, maybe they got money, maybe they really don't. Maybe when it comes time for them to retire, they're not going to have the money to pay it. Or if they've got long-term care issues, they're not going to have the money to take care of themselves. What people have is not necessarily the indication of how wealthy they are.
And yeah, maybe, I should add, you know, my delusion with the book and with the things that Dan talks about is that people of all income levels, whether they're struggling or whether they're comfortable, are sort of freed from some of the burdens of money. I think that we spend so much mental capital obsessing and worrying about money that if we learn a little bit about how we think and just learn some shortcuts and some ways to like think better, that'll free our minds to do other things. And those that are struggling in particular, who spend so much of their time worrying about money, just having some relief from that, I think will help them moving forward. And we can help with that, and just taking a moment to stop and think for anyone will.
And you asked a good question about whether or not it's okay to spend all that money. The fact of the matter is, no. If you don't have a retirement savings, if you don't have the savings to send your kid to college, you don't have an emergency fund, you don't have a pot if something happens, then no, you can't go to Vegas. No, you can't go to Disney World and spend all that crazy money on that little twirly thing that they gonna break before you get home. No, you can't do it. I'm sorry to tell you that, because you got to think about your future and what's really of value when something happens. Now, once you have all those pots and they're going well, yeah, sure, go to Disney, spend money on that crazy stuff. But until you do, I'm telling you now, don't do it. Because you'll end up in the classes that I teach or reading my column talking about, oh, I got no money to send my kid to college. And I don't want that for you. You got to have financial peace. And that will then free you up to do the things that really value to you.
Dina emailed, how is the gig economy having an effect on how people spend and save? Jeff, I'd love you to take this question. Dina writes, I recently left a salaried career to pursue a career as a musician. I'll come away from a gig with a big check feeling like I have all this new money to spend, but really I've only gotten myself a fraction closer to that month's rent. Jeff, what do you think?
Well, it's a big challenge, and I've spent my entire career as basically a freelancer, and I often tell a story. There was one year where in January of that year, I made $12,000, and in February of that year, I made $120. And that just, it makes it so hard to plan and to think about savings and think about spending, and you have a family and responsibilities, and it was always a challenge for me. And what we need to do is to think long term, is to try as best we can to say, okay, I've got this $12,000. It's not a bonus. It's not a splurge money. Yes, if we made $12,000 every month, it would be great. But to think about the reality of our income and potential income. And for those in the gig economy, the freelance economy, whatever it's called, it really is a challenge, because there's no automatic paycheck deduction to put into your 401k. You have to do it yourself. And it's the extra step. Again, think about that pain of paying. You're paying for your future self. It's more difficult for those of us that live that way, but it's something that we really need to do so that if we get 520 months in a row, we are not in big, big trouble.
The other real challenge with this is the way that American taxes work. So, you know, if you get $12,000 one month, a third of it has to go to the side to pay for taxes. But, you know, if you have a job, they automatically withhold it. If you're in the gig economy, 1099, you don't feel that. You don't have it. And often people get to the end of the year and just don't have enough money for taxes. Right. So you know, if we have this kind of really interesting inflow and outflow of money, so people who have a stable job has inflow of money, let's say, every 2 weeks or every month. And then we have daily expenses, weekly expenses, biannual expenses, annual expenses. And it's hard to make sense of it. I mean, just imagine two people. They both get paid on the last day of the month. One of them has their rent coming out on the first of the month, and one of them has the rent come on the 20th of the month. What's the difference in the feeling of those two people? The person who has their rent comes out on the first of the month, they know how much money they basically have. The person who has their rent comes on the 20th of the month, for 20 days they think they're extra wealthy. They look at their checking balance and they feel they're extra wealthy. And this is the issue. We look at our checking balance as an indication of how much money we have, but in fact we owe money for taxes, we need to put money in 401k. And people in the gig economy in particular have these challenges of kind of inferring from their fluctuating checking balance how much money they actually have and what their bills are and so on. And I think there are some interesting new approaches to reflect for people what's called safe to spend amount, how much they should actually spend. But it's really a tough exercise to do, but we need to figure it out. Otherwise, spending is going out.
I'll give a quick tip for one thing I've
found. Very briefly, we're almost out of time.
Yep, I have multiple accounts, so that my checking account, my main spending, that's not where I put the money I earn, so that I don't suddenly splurge. I put it in a separate account, and then I parse that out to myself.
In Panama?
Yes, Panama and Paradise is the new one.
Of course it's in Panama. Jeff Kreisler, co-author of Dollars and Cents, How We Misthink Money and How to Spend Smarter. Jeff, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Dan Ariely, the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics and the founder and director of the Center of Advanced Hindsight at Duke. Dan, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Great being here.
And Michelle Singletary, syndicated columnist of The Color of Money for The Washington Post. Thank you, Michelle.
Oh, you're so welcome. Don't spin, y'all.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.